Hello and welcome to The Contrarian View, a podcast for investors who like to think and invest a little differently. I'm Nicola Dormel, an investment specialist at Orbis Investments. This series is about the courage and discipline it takes to go against the crowd, especially when the noise is relentless and consensus feels comforting, because some of the most rewarding opportunities are often found in the unloved and overlooked parts of the market. Joining me today is Alec Cutler, seasoned contrarian and portfolio manager of the Orbis Global Balanced and Global Cautious Fund. Alec's belief in independent thinking started early thanks to an investment-savvy grandmother who sparked his curiosity. That mindset was later shaped by his time serving in the US Navy and tested across decades of managing money through bubbles and crashes and everything in between. In this conversation, we'll explore the mindset behind differentiated thinking, the structure that supports it, and how that discipline plays out in long-term portfolio decisions. So with that, Alec, let's kick off. What at its heart does contrarian investing mean, and why do you think that can serve investors well over the long term?
I think at its heart, contrarian investing is about, as you summarized, it's being willing to do what others are not willing to do and invest in what's uncomfortable. And things that are uncomfortable tend to be undervalued because people don't want to do it. So there's often opportunity there. That doesn't mean that everything that is cheap and unloved is a great opportunity. Being contrary can be a disaster. A contrarian filters through all the contrary ideas, the things that are way out of favor, and uses their intellect and their effort to find those few investments that are very likely to return to some sort of normal valuation.
And thinking of a contrarian mindset, do you think that's something that develops over time, or do you think it's innate and it comes down to having the right temperament?
I think it's about having a screw loose. I think it's a recessive trait, and it's very rare to find a true contrarian. And when I think about why it's rare, I always like to go back to caveman times. But if you were a contrarian back in caveman times, your life expectancy was quite short. The contrarian back in caveman times would have, you know, wondered what it would be like to go out at night and to wander around in the forest at night and would get eaten by a saber-toothed tiger. Whereas, the rest of the people that didn't have that gene would have stayed safe in the cave and survived. So I think, you know, most contrarians didn't make it past caveman times. And that sort of follows throughout history. You really don't want to be a contrarian. It's not good for your lifespan. So I think there aren't many. It's fairly rare. It's also very hard to do. So you can it can be quite unpleasant, and most people tend not to like to do unpleasant things.
But admittedly, you know, contrarian investors, we aren't robots. We also feel that knot in our stomach, particularly when the market direction goes in the other way. And that temptation to pull the ripcord. But we need to make sure we don't capitulate. So what are some of the practices or structures in place to help you not to capitulate and to stay the course and hold your nerve in those tricky times?
Well, sometimes it's going for a walk and not pushing the button because it can be quite tempting. And there were times, particularly during COVID in 2020, where we talked about the best decisions were the decisions not to do anything. And it was the hardest decision, the urge to take action if there's danger, if there's something that appears to be scary or going wrong, the urge is to actually take action when no action is the appropriate course. So that's number one. Number two is, if the reason you bought it, you determine is not going to happen, or short term, you're wrong, then you've got to sell it. And that's something that we learn over time. It's very hard to do. It's very hard to admit you're wrong, but it's very important that you do.
Alec, so at the start, I alluded to your investment-savvy grandmother, and I'd love to learn more about her influence on your investing career.
You know, she wasn't just a random grandmother. Her husband, my grandfather, had a seat on the stock exchange. He was a very good investor in his own right, but I never knew him. He died. And when he died in 1969, the partners in his firm went to my grandmother and said, you know, you need to sell Charlie's seat to us. And she said, why? And they said, because women don't hold seats on the New York Stock Exchange. And she said, well, what are you going to pay me for it? And she didn't like the answer, and she refused to sell it to them. So she actually held that seat until the late 80s and sold it near the peak valuation. But she knew a lot about investing. A very, very smart woman. And it's all from what she picked up at cocktail parties and conversations with her husband and his clients and his partners. But it was the basics. It was the important stuff. She managed her portfolio after her husband died. So from 1969 until she passed away, she successfully managed her own money. When she used to show me her portfolio and we go through it and track it, it's not too far off what we do today at Orbis. And I think it's just, it's super important how enduring some of these basic principles are. And, you know, I keep her picture very handy.
Oh, that's amazing.
And that's my daughter, and I'm teaching her everything I know how to invest, but she's 28 now, so I think I've taught her everything I know.
And what do you think some of those enduring principles are that have stayed with you?
You know, it's the importance of valuation. She knew the, and it's the important bits of valuation. You don't need to get super in depth about, you know, EBITDA this and EV that. You know, what are they earning? What cash are they producing? And then what are you paying for those earnings in cash? And how much do you get in a dividend? That's it.
And your investing career spans multiple decades, and you've witnessed various market crashes and market bubbles. And I think, admittedly, you know, contrarian investing means we disagree with the market. But at some point, you want the market to agree with you so you can be rewarded for those ideas. What tends to move the sentiment and causes that cycle to shift?
You never know. And sometimes it takes months for a catalyst to deliver the result being the market agreeing with us on a stock or a sector or an asset class. Sometimes it takes years. And sometimes it can be painfully long. This last cycle has been very difficult for value or contrarian managers, the cycle being from the global financial crisis through to, you know, the last 3 years, I would say, we're back into some sort of a value cycle where value and valuation matter again. But that staying power, the ability to wait and be patient is a critical skill and a critical element of a successful product.
Our late founder, Alan Gray, there was a quote that always stuck with me. The prosperity of good times tends to produce the tough times. And I think it's a sobering reminder, particularly in optimistic markets. How does that idea influence your view of cycles and help you stay particularly patient when the narrative turns against you?
The recognition that things change, like the seasons. It's just that, unfortunately, you know, the timing's not as predictable as the seasons, but summer yields to fall and yields to winter, and then winter yields to spring. Everything in life is cycles if you think in long enough terms, and we just have to be patient enough to ride them out, and hopefully we've built a portfolio that has things going from winter to spring in the portfolio at different times, so we kind of have an assembly line of positions and ideas in the portfolio, such as some are coming to fruition where the market's agreeing with us, while we're rolling new ones on that can be quite painful.
So we've spoken a fair bit about a contrarian mindset, staying the course, being able to hold your nerve, but hopefully now keen to unpack how that actually plays out in the portfolio today. Now, there seems to be a big structural shift underway. We're moving from a fairly globalized world to one of more economic nationalism, with a real focus on things like energy, food, and industrial resilience. And you sort of refer to Maslow's hierarchy of needs. And, you know, for quite some time, everyone's been focused at the top of the pyramid and neglected those foundations, food, energy, defense. Can you share a little bit more about that lens? How did we get to where we are today, and what does that mean for the investing landscape?
Yeah, so if I think about it in a historical context, after the fall of the Berlin Wall, we had what then became known as the peace dividend, and we had prosperity, and we had things like globalization that really started in 2001 when China joined the WTO. We had, I think, what people will fondly remember as good times, peaceful times, a time where, if you think about what it takes to be a viable country, you don't need to worry about the bottom of the pyramid. And you think about the pyramid of needs or any kind of pyramid, you need the base to be solid in order to support the things that are higher up in the pyramid. You didn't have to worry about national security. Things at the bottom of the pyramid, national security, energy security, food security, and then maybe just a little bit above that, industrial security. Do we have a vibrant community where we can work and have jobs and produce products that are viable in the world? You didn't really have to, those were kind of a given. And society is particularly in the Western world focused on the higher order things, on the pyramid of needs, social programs, self-esteem. Those are great and those are lovely things. But if you do it to the point where you're neglecting your foundation and the foundation starts to crumble, you can no longer do those things. You don't have the necessary bits of your society and your pyramid. You don't have a healthy economy. You don't have border security. You don't have a reliable energy supply, since we're speaking in the UK. These things start falling apart. And that's what's happened now, is a recognition that all those higher order things were nice to haves, not have to haves. You have to have food. You have to have energy. You have to have security. You have to have a decent industrial policy. And a vibrant commerce, or you can't have those things. You just can't afford them. And I think that's where we are now.
And in terms of the opportunities and risks that those have-to-haves, if you will, produce for contrarian investors, what is bubbling up from the bottom up?
Yeah. So if you look at a good chunk of the multi-asset funds equity portfolio, it's focused on those bottom of the pyramid opportunities. And there are plenty of them that exist. We started years ago with national security. We owned a lot of defense stocks. We continue to own them, although we're trimming them. Energy security, critical energy infrastructure, we've talked about for years. The world is catching on to that being a big deal, and we're seeing those names pay off. But around the edges of those themes, if you will, are constantly emerging new ideas in the less known parts of the market. So we continue to benefit from focusing on those bottom of the pyramid of the needs themes.
You touched on valuations earlier being super cheap, but some might argue sometimes companies are cheap and cheap for good reason. And yeah. I think the classic question is always, well, how do you go about avoiding a value trap?
A lot of work. I mean, that's what our analyst team does. That's what we all do. We're all analysts. We try to separate the wheat from the chaff. It's just classic, almost biblical lines that stand the test of time. There are, at any given time, 20% of the companies are in the 20th least expensive part of the market. But it doesn't mean you just buy all those names. 80% of them, or a great many of them, are there for a good reason. They're a crummy company. So it's doing the work to figure out what is a crummy company, or should put it in the positive, what are the few very attractive companies that have decent long-term prospects? And then the filter that can go on top of that is, can we identify a catalyst? So if we have so many opportunities that we have too many opportunities for the portfolio, we can then go through and put an extra layer on, say, which of these have a catalyst that we can identify that can trigger that return to normal valuation.
I think from a regional perspective, if you look at our multi-asset portfolios, very, very little exposure to the US, which I think many would observe is quite a contrarian stance. And sometimes I speak to clients and they look at valuations and there's some sense of appreciation, but equally there is the counter argument to say, well, the US is the economic powerhouse. It's the hub of innovation, the entrepreneurial spirit. How can you not have more exposure to the US? What would your counter be to that?
Valuation, valuation, valuation. First of all, the US is exceptional. It's exceptionally expensive, the stock market. The level of complacency is bizarrely high. So running $37 trillion in debt, 120% debt to GDP, that's a wartime level of debt. That's World War II. We're not at war. This is peacetime. And we're in an economic expansion that's been going on for a long time. So this is the most successful country in the world economically throughout, since World War II, certainly. Its percentage of global GDP has been between 18 and 25%. And it toggles back and forth between 18 and 25%. So it's 25% now. I wonder what's next. Is it 27? Is it 29? Is it 30? I don't think so. I think it's probably more likely to toggle back to 18. But that's its proportion of economic output. Its proportion of the equity markets is 67 up to 70%, something like that. Way out of whack. And that's not, the U.S. isn't the only country that's ever done that. Japan, which I'm not sure ever got above 15% as a percentage of global domestic product, at one point was 50% of global markets. So Japan was exceptional at one point. The U.S. is exceptional now. The probability that the U.S. is exceptional in 5 and 10 and 15 years drops as you go further and further out. It's just the way the world works. It's the way cycles work. The U.S. isn't endowed with any permanent advantage that is insurmountable from other countries that could potentially knock the U.S. off from an exceptional standpoint. So it's very likely that that will happen. That's helped along, by the way, by hubris. So when you start thinking you're the best, this is a competitive thing. The global economy is a competitive place. If you think you're the best for long enough, someone's going to bump you off. And the U.S., everyone's telling the U.S. it's exceptional and tons of money is flowing into the U.S. You know, that's just teeing it up for the cycle to turn the other way. You know, oftentimes in contrarian investing, it's not about where you are statically. It's about where the arrows are pointing. And if the U.S. was perceived to be exceptional in the beginning of January, the arrows have all pointed down since then, whether it's economic activity, earnings, growth, the U.S. perception in the rest of the world, the ability or desire to cut debt or cut expenses. All those arrows are pointed down, and yet optimism and reign supreme, it just looks like a lot of complacency. We find better opportunities in the smaller names, the mid-caps, the boring, mundane companies that maybe move natural gas around the country, not super interesting. Nobody really wants to talk to you at a cocktail party about pipelines. But there aren't many of those from a market cap standpoint. So we tend to be quite underweight the U.S. At the same time, there are amazing opportunities around the rest of the world. So it's kind of part there's too much expensive stuff there, and part there's really attractive stuff demanding capital outside the U.S.
Another contrarian view, and a certainly very contrarian positioning at the time, was the portfolio's exposure to defense stocks. And we started buying those companies probably around 5-6 years ago. What was the thinking at the time?
They were super cheap. The European Union was getting ready to launch what they called social taxonomy, and it was a tax that they wanted to put on companies that produce social ill. And right at the top of the list, the hit list, if you will, were defense stocks. And that forced, it was also declared sort of being on the wrong side of ESG at a time when ESG was the popular investment style. And you know, companies when funds were being renamed sustainable this and green that. So a lot of funds were divesting themselves of particularly European defense contractors. So it's purely, you know, my grandmother on my shoulder saying, you know, these are companies that have decent futures that are selling at 5 or 6 times earnings. And they're all oligopolies. There aren't, you know, this isn't a super competitive market. And then, you know, from a contrarian standpoint, can we foresee an environment where they will come back into favor? And that wasn't hard to see. I mean, Russia invaded Ukraine in 2014 and didn't leave. And we're ready to roll again. Like, this was not going to – this is going to happen. So it was a – it was kind of a nice – not a great subject matter, but a nice confluence of valuation and catalyst.
It would be remiss not to talk to about artificial intelligence today. So maybe I'll just start off. Are you a user of ChatGPT?
I'm not actually. Well, I kind of, you know, if you, I toggle back and forth between the ones that are having the free trials because I just don't want to pay for it. And
you value can get, investor.
That's right. I guess I dabble with it, and it's great for giving you a quick answer. Then you have to figure out whether it's the right answer or not. But if you want to know what the great restaurants in the town you're visiting, it's fantastic. Or a very quick answer about where a company's located, or, you know, kind of use it for things like that. AI is just, it's a continuation of the world and information becoming more accessible. Is it as important and monumental as the internet and spreadsheets and email that all kind of came, and Windows that all came out at the same time and, you know, led to a 3% per annum increase in productivity from 1995 to 2005? I don't know. We'll see. But from an investment standpoint, it's just another step in the continuing accessibility of information to investors. But pure information isn't really where a contrarian gets their edge. It's great. So we can get information faster. But it still doesn't change the fact that you're investing where nobody's interested. So maybe it just makes people less interested faster. I don't know. And it makes for an industry or a company going out of favor faster. But it doesn't change that basic human psychology that all still goes back to caveman times, like we talked about. So the underlying theme here from being a contrarian investor, a modern contrarian investor, is you don't want to be blind to what's going on in the world. So the old school value investor might say, that stuff's newfangled and we can't find any value there and it's confusing and so we just avoid it entirely. When there is something new and something's accelerating in importance in the world, we try and understand it. And then we try to find ways that we can develop investments that can grow where we don't have to pay a lot for it. So and I think AI is a great example. The center of the bullseye of AI are the megascalers, the Microsofts and Googles and Amazons and Metas, where people look at them and they look at the positives. They see AI is an amazing thing and they're helping drive this and they're going to develop new growth markets from it. That's all great. So they've got these massive multiples because they're at the center of attention of AI, which everyone's infatuated with. There's also considerable risk there. So you're paying this huge multiple for the upside that might happen, but AI is also leveling the playing field amongst competition for the things that they do already. So their cash cows, Google, for instance, gets all its money from search. Find me an 18-year-old that uses Google search, that Googles anything. They use ChatGPT. And Google's trying to react with Gemini. And they may wind up giving away Gemini to protect their cash cow to the degree that it's protectable when somebody else has a competing product that didn't exist before. So there's a lot of risk in that, and they all have similar risks. all their cash cows are at risk now because of AI. But leave that to the side. We're not going to invest in those right now. What else is, how else can we play that? Is there a way that we can play that? Outside of that, so who's providing the ammunition to these companies that are competing, that are at war with each other to win? You get to NVIDIA, and everyone's excited about NVIDIA. NVIDIA is the arms dealer for AI. NVIDIA is expensive. Okay, so we're not gonna buy that today. Maybe tomorrow. Maybe it'll get cheap and we can buy it tomorrow. Who provides the services that enable NVIDIA? Taiwan Semiconductor makes NVIDIA's chips. NVIDIA doesn't make anything, practically doesn't make anything. It uses Taiwan Semiconductor to make the chips. And then if you look at a circuit board that has the NVIDIA chip on it, so it's surrounded by dynamic random access memory chips, the chips that get the information in and out of that NVIDIA chip really, really fast. We own those companies. That's Micron, it's Hynix, it's Samsung. All four of those companies, Taiwan Semiconductor and the three, the oligopoly that is memory, are not expensive. They're reasonably valued. They're perceived to be lower quality, cyclical tech backwaters, if you will. But they're integral to AI. There is no AI without those four companies, full stop. Outside of that ring, so you build this AI factory in the middle of the desert somewhere, you spend $100 billion making this factory. That factory can't operate without electricity. AI gobbles electricity like nobody's business. We own the companies that make the critical energy infrastructure that generates that electricity and gets that electricity to where it needs to be. We own the natural gas transport company that gets the natural gas to the gas turbine that spins and makes electricity. Those companies are reasonably valued. Every company I've mentioned, every sector I've just mentioned, have done quite well for us, but are still very, very attractively valued.
We sort of referred to Maslow's hierarchy a little bit earlier, and energy security being one of those foundations. How do we pragmatically solve for energy security in a world where we also try to be responsible citizens?
Yeah, so if we think about trying to create energy, and the energy form of today is electricity, that's the cleanest form of energy, prime mover of energy, but you have to make the electricity. So we want more electricity, but we have to make more electricity. We got the world fantasized about windmills and solar panels. And then recently has come around to the logic behind that and physics and chemistry getting in the way of wants and desires and platitudes about what would be wonderful, a world that's where electricity is run by windmills and solar panels. So they just can't do it. They're nice to look at, and they're a nice element of a healthy electricity grid, but you need stable sources of spinning load, if you will, load that is there all the time, ready to roll. The only forms of that can do that is coal. So steam powered by coal, steam powered by nuclear energy, or natural gas turbines. Of those three, coal's out. I mean, coal is legitimately a nasty energy source. Natural gas, not so nasty. It doesn't create any particulate. It does create some CO2. That CO2 can be ameliorated through different carbon capture methods. Nuclear is carbon-free, but has drawbacks. Every energy source has drawbacks. You need to have an appropriate mix of them such that you can run a healthy grid and not take too much pollution risk. So what we have is, you know, riding on top and producing when it feels like producing is wind and solar. Then from a baseload standpoint and is nuclear. So nuclear running all the time, providing that, you know, steady 20 to 40% of electricity output all the time. And then for peaks, particularly when it's not windy and it's cloudy, those gas turbine plants can ramp up and ramp down quite quickly. That's what makes a healthy grid. We saw this at peak ESG 5-6 years ago, that this fascination with quote unquote renewable energy was going to make for a very unhealthy grid, and that eventually the governments and regulators and those decision makers would have to come around and re-embrace nuclear and re-embrace natural gas, which is where a lot of our original investments in critical energy infrastructure came from.
And Alec, I think just to close things off, if you reflect back over your career, what is the one lesson that you wish more investors understood when it comes to going against the grain?
Jeez. Patience keeps coming to mind. I mean, you have to have a thick skin. You can't be too into immediate gratification. And then I think, you know, close behind that is we solve puzzles. We have the best job in the world. We go to work every day and we learn new stuff and we solve puzzles. So if you don't enjoy that, then don't get into contrarian investing.
Well, Alec, thank you very much. That was a really insightful way to kickstart the series. And thank you very much for listening. And for those of you who would like to hear more contrarian insights, please visit Orbis.com or follow us on LinkedIn. Thank you very much.